If you had to lose one of your senses, which would you choose? So you've got five senses: sight, hearing, touch, taste, smell. So which one would you give up first? So in ranking them in order of importance, order of value, which would be at the bottom of your list? For me, probably smell. I don't know about you, for me, probably smell. I think losing that would affect me least. Don't get me wrong, I love the smell of freshly baked bread and spring flowers and, you know, the seaside. And nasty niffs are a pretty helpful warning sign to have. But if one sense had to go, I think I'd opt for that one. Okay, which of your senses do you value most? So if you had to list them in order of value, which would be top of the list? Which would you find it hardest to lose? For me, I think pretty much certainly sight. I can't imagine not being able to see. Not being able to see the faces of loved ones, the beauty of the natural world, colours, able to read books, watch films, just being in the dark and dependent on others to guide you. I'd find that personally incredibly hard. There was a TV producer called Vanessa Potter. She was in perfect health, and one day out of nowhere, she started to lose her vision, and she was admitted to hospital. And 3 days later, she was completely blind. Utterly terrifying. Although people who are blind adapt, don't they, in remarkable ways, they would be, I'm sure, the first to admit that it is a serious disability. Even in a modern Western society like our own, and never mind in a poorer country, where you really are helpless. So in New Testament times, the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, they're mentioned together as a group of the most helpless people in that society. Thankfully, though, blindness is not that common. So in the UK, 5 out of 1,000 people are registered blind. But there is a spiritual equivalent which is much more widespread. Imagine a global pandemic, not of a virus, but of blindness. Imagine everyone went blind. Well, that, the Bible tells us, is the true state of humanity. That we are spiritually blind. We're groping around in the dark. But the good news is that Jesus can heal us. He can give us sight. And that is the message of the bit in Mark's Gospel we've just read. And you'll find it helpful to have it open in front of you. It tells us that we are spiritually blind, but that Jesus can open our eyes. First then, as on the outline, blind eyes, that by nature we are spiritually blind. In verse 10, Jesus heads back by boat across to the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. Verse 11, he's met by a group of Pharisees who've come to cause trouble. We read, they began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. Testing Jesus. That's what the devil did back in 1:13. 3 other times it comes up in Mark's Gospel. It is the Pharisees who are doing it. They're testing Jesus. They were out to discredit him. They were out to trip him up. They demanded proof of his divine authority. They wanted yet another sign, yet another miracle, as if he hadn't done plenty already. And they just sort of held up more and more hoops for Jesus to jump through. And Jesus responds with dismay and with despair. You'll see in verse 12, it says that he sighed deeply in his spirit. And he said, why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I tell you, no sign will be given to this generation. And he left them. Sort of symbolic parting of the ways. So these Jewish religious leaders, they had closed minds, they had hard hearts, they had blind eyes. Now, it doesn't specifically say that here, that they were spiritually blind, but we had in our first reading, Matthew 23, that Jesus revealed that this was their problem. He denounced them 5 times in that passage as spiritually blind. You blind guides, he said, you blind fools, you blind men. You blind Pharisee. So just as Isaiah, years before, had condemned the leaders of God's Old Testament people. He'd said that his watchmen are blind. But such spiritual blindness was not limited to the Pharisees. What was true of them was true in verse 12, Jesus said, of this generation. But the biggest shock is that it was true even of Jesus' own closest disciples, the apostles. So in verse 13, Jesus heads back across the lake with his disciples, but it is clear that they have not left the problem behind them on the shore with the Pharisees. The problem has come in the boat with them. The disciples' failure to understand reveals that they too are spiritually blind. So in verse 15, Jesus warns them. He says, "Watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." Now, the Pharisees and Herod, they were both opposed to Jesus. They both refused to repent and believe. Their attitude to Jesus, he said, was like leaven. It was like yeast which spreads. I was baking some bread this last Monday. You mix up your flour, the water. You sprinkle in just 8 grams of dried yeast. But in no time at all, it spreads throughout the entire batch of dough. Jesus warned his disciples, but it was too late. The yeast had clearly already got into them. They were spiritually blind. So in verse 16, they miss the point completely. They think the issue is that they didn't pack any bread. And Jesus is clearly pretty upset with them, isn't he? He's frustrated. He lets fly with his barrage of questions in verses 17 and 18. He says, "Why are you discussing the fact you've no bread? Don't you yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear?" So hard hearts, deaf ears, blind eyes. In verses 19 to 21, he asked them about the 2 feeding miracles that they'd witnessed. And he says, you know, how much was left over? And there's no problem with their memory. They remember very clearly, but they just don't get the significance of what Jesus did. That he is the Christ, he is the Messiah. It's a desperate situation, isn't it? They'd been with Jesus all this time. They've listened to his teaching, they've witnessed the miracles he's done, but they just don't get it. They're no better off than the Pharisees. Now, it's not just that they need a little bit more time to figure it out and join the dots and get more information. To use the line from Star Trek, it's worse than that. He's dead, Jim. Or in this case, it's worse than that. They're blind, Jim. They're blind. They're spiritually blind. And they're responsible for it. So it's a guilty blindness because of their sinful rebellion. The prophet Ezekiel said of God's people back in the Old Testament, Ezekiel 12:2, he said, "They are a rebellious house who have eyes to see, but see not." And what was true of them is true of all of us by nature, that we are spiritually blind. Like the Pharisees, like the disciples, like that whole generation, like every generation. You've probably seen one of these tables. I don't know where you'd put yourself. I think probably most at the barge are millennials, probably the majority of millennials. Some are Gen Z, some of us are Generation X, and so on and so forth. The different generations have different characteristics, don't they? So, you know, Gen Z, they're all digital natives. They've grown up with smartphones, social media. Millennials place a high priority, apparently, on self-esteem, psychological health, issues of injustice and oppression, and on it goes. There are differences. But what we all have in common, every generation, is that we are spiritually blind by nature. Every generation is born blind. And so, like the disciples, we are in real trouble. God offers us rescue if we will repent and believe in Jesus, but we don't get it. We don't get it. Our hearts are hard. Our ears are deaf. Our eyes are blind. 2 Corinthians 4 verse 4 says that the God of this world, that's speaking of the devil, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. And that leaves us in real trouble. The 19th century missionary Amy Carmichael spent over 50 years in southern India serving the poor, sharing the good news of Jesus. For her final 20 years, she was confined to her bed after an accident, and she wrote an awful lot from her bed. And one piece she wrote was a dream in which she finds herself on an expanse of grass next to a cliff edge. In her dream, in her horror, she sees crowds and crowds of people walking across the grass towards the edge, towards the cliff edge. And she writes this. All were blind, stone blind. All made straight for the precipice edge. There were shrieks as they suddenly knew themselves falling, and a tossing up of helpless arms, catching, clutching at empty air. But some went over quietly and fell without a sound. It's a moving picture, isn't it, of humanity, spiritually blind and walking over the cliff edge of death and judgment to eternal destruction below. The other day, I found myself thinking about some of the guys I'd been with at university and some of the guys I'd rode with back in those days, and I just wondered what these guys were doing now, so I looked some of them up online. Some of them have done very well for themselves. Senior positions, CEOs of this and that and so on. Worldly success. But the reality is that they're in real trouble. They're in huge danger. Spiritually blind, as far as I know, and still walking towards the cliff edge unaware. What hope is there? Well, the only hope is Jesus, that he alone can open blind eyes. And he demonstrates that in the second half of the passage. So let's turn from blind eyes to our second point, opened eyes. In verse 22, we read that they came to Bethsaida. So Bethsaida, you'll see on the map there, was on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. It was home to at least three of the 12 apostles. And some people brought to Jesus a blind man and begged him to touch him. In verse 23, Jesus takes this man by the hand. He lays his hands on him. And verse 25, we read that he opened his eyes and his sight was restored. And he saw everything clearly. We've noticed that the Pharisees and the disciples were spiritually blind. Immediately after those verses, we now find a physically blind man is brought to Jesus and he heals him. Now, it's not a coincidence. It's deliberate. The two passages there are clearly connected. And the point is that Jesus can cure spiritual blindness. And he proves it. He proves that he can do it spiritually by doing it physically. Jesus can open blind eyes. That's the point. Now, this is precisely what the Old Testament prophets foretold the Messiah would do when he came. So, Isaiah 29:18, in that day, the eyes of the blind shall see. Or Isaiah 35:5, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened. Isaiah 42:6-7, the Lord said of the servant he would send, I will give you as a light for the nations to open the eyes that are blind. So the Messiah, when he came, he would open blind eyes, physically and supremely spiritually. So the physical miracle is a picture. It's a demonstration of the spiritual miracle that he alone can do. But, and you'll have noticed this when it was read, but what is unusual is that the healing happens in two stages. In two stages. So when Jesus first lays his hand on this blind man and asks him if he can see anything, what does the blind man reply? Verse 24, he says, I see men, but they look like trees walking. So he sees, but he only sees with blurred vision. People, they look like trees. And so, verse 25, Jesus lays his hands on him again, a second time. And only then do we read that he sees everything clearly. Now, what's going on? Why a miracle in two stages? The only miracle, this is the only miracle recorded in the gospel accounts, which isn't instantaneous. Why? Was it that Jesus just didn't have the power to do it in one go? I mean, surely not. I mean, he's already done instantly things that we might consider to be sort of harder miracles, such as, you know, raising a dead girl to life. We'd say, well, that seems a bit harder than healing a blind person. So why two stages here? Well, it's very deliberate. It's picturing a spiritual reality. It's teaching us that the healing of spiritual blindness is not going to be immediate and in one go. It will happen in two stages, just like the physical healing. And that is precisely what we witness in the final verses of the passage. So verses 27 to 30, we witness a man who is healed by Jesus of his spiritual blindness, but his vision is still blurred. So verse 27, Jesus moves on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. You'll see on the map there. So it's further up north. In fact, it's 25 miles north of Bethsaida, where they were with a blind man. So a full day's walk. And on the way, Jesus asks them in verse 27, who do people say that I am? Disciples give a sample of the wrong answers, the wrong ideas, which were doing the rounds at the time. John the Baptist, Elijah, one of the prophets. So, you know, someone special but not unique. I guess just like many today who would say that, you know, Jesus was a great man. He was very special, moral example, but not unique, nothing more. But then Jesus makes it personal. Then he makes it personal, verse 29. He says, but who do you say that I am? You say, never mind about the crowds now. Never mind what they think. Never mind what the survey results say. What about you? You personally. Who do you think I am? And the question he put to them then on the road to Caesarea Philippi, he puts to us each of us today. Who do you say that I am? How would you answer at the moment? Because everything, absolutely everything, hangs on our response to that question. Verse 29, Peter answered, you are the Christ. We think, yes, finally somebody has got it. I mean, as readers of Mark's gospel, we've known this from the very beginning, haven't we? From chapter 1, verse 1, the very first line of Mark's gospel said, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. But now, finally, one of the actors in the drama itself has got it. Jesus is the Christ. He's the promised king, the anointed one. That's the Messiah, the Christ, the anointed one. So Peter hits the bullseye. But how? How did he get it? I mean, just think about it. In the boat, just now, crossing the lake, Peter was there with the other disciples. He was as clueless as the rest of them. He, like the other disciples, he'd been in the dark. Jesus had denounced him, just like the others, as having a hard heart, deaf ears, blind eyes. So how come he now suddenly gets it? Well, what happened between the boat crossing and this walk now to Caesarea Philippi? What happened between? Jesus healed a blind man. And the only conclusion we're left to draw is this, that Jesus has now done the same for Peter. He's opened his eyes. He's healed his spiritual blindness, so that now he can see who Jesus is. Now, what Jesus did for Peter back then, he needs to do for us today. He needs to do for us today. So if we are to see, if we are to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the promised King, we need him to open our blind eyes. We need this miracle. We all do. Whatever our background. I mean, Peter, a Jew, he was one of Jesus' closest followers. He needed that just as much as the far-off Gentiles did. And so does each of us. 2 Corinthians 4, I mentioned already, Paul, he says that the devil has blinded the minds of unbelievers. They can't see the light of the gospel. But then he says in verse 6, God who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone in our hearts. Now that is what God has done for every believer. He has switched on the light in our darkened hearts. He has opened our blind eyes. So if you do believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, if you've received him personally, that is only because he has had mercy on you and he's opened your eyes. It is not because you are more intelligent or moral than others. It's not that you are less rebellious or sinful than others. You and I, we were just like Herod, we were just like the Pharisees, we were just like the disciples, spiritually blind. But Jesus has opened our eyes. So that we can see who Jesus is, it is a miracle for which we should be daily thankful. So as the hymn Amazing Grace says, I was blind, but now I see. And if you don't yet get who Jesus is, what should you do? Well, take a closer look at him. Read through one of the gospel accounts, perhaps with a Christian friend. Join the Life Explored course, which has just begun on Tuesday evenings. But as you do that, pray that the Lord would open your blind eyes. In Matthew 20, verses 29 to 34, we read that there were two blind men sitting by the roadside one day as Jesus was passing by. And they called out to him, they said, Lord, have mercy on us, let our eyes be opened. And immediately they recovered their sight and they started following him. Is Jesus any less willing to do that today? Well, no, he isn't. Well, therefore, call out to him for sight. Say, Lord, please have mercy on me and open my eyes. So Peter's eyes had been opened. He could now see. Or could he? Well, he could see, but he could only see partially. He's like the blind man in Bethsaida, that he could now see people, but they looked like trees walking. His vision was blurred. And this blurry vision is very apparent in the next exchange with Jesus in verse 31 onwards. We're going to study that when we meet again next week. But it's apparent that he could see now that Jesus was the Christ, but he could not see what that meant. He couldn't see what that meant. He didn't get why Jesus had come, that Jesus had come to suffer and to die. And Peter would need a further miracle to be able to understand and see that clearly. So the blind man in Bethsaida, he came to see in two stages, and Peter would need the same two-stage opening of his spiritually blind eyes. And so our eyes need opening not just to who Jesus is, but also to why he has come. Getting who Jesus is, that's vital, but it's not enough. We need to see not just the identity of Jesus, we need to also see his mission. And we need, in fact, the second half of Mark's gospel. The first half of Mark's gospel has been about the identity of Jesus. Who is he? And it's all been building up to this climactic confession by Peter, saying, you are the Christ. The second half of Mark's gospel will now focus on his mission. Why has he come? On what sort of Christ he is. That he's a Christ who has come to suffer and to die and then rise again. In the first half of Mark's gospel, Jesus has been up north. He's been crisscrossing the Sea of Galilee again and again, as we've seen over the past weeks. And now from this point on, from this turning point, Jesus is going to be heading to Jerusalem, where he will suffer and die. The death, the resurrection of Jesus, the very heart of the Christian faith. So just last weekend, we celebrated these events, didn't we, at Easter. Do we get why the Easter events are so important? Do we see why Jesus had to die? that he was dying for our sins to rescue us from the judgment we deserve. If we do, and if you're someone who says today, Jesus died for me, if you can say that today, there's only one explanation. Jesus has opened our blind eyes so that we can see clearly. And what he's done for us, he can do for others. And so we should be praying for that. For the Lord to have mercy on those we know, those we love, who are spiritually blind, and to open their eyes too. To open them fully so they can clearly see both who Jesus is and why he came, and receive him. Now, the fact that for the blind man and for the spiritually blind Peter, the fact that it happened in these two stages, I guess one question we may have is, well, does that mean then that for everyone, it's a two-stage process? I think the answer is clearly no. This is a unique moment in salvation history, as Jesus gradually revealed to his disciples who he was and then why he had come. We can now look back, can't we, on that complete revelation. And so a person's eyes now may be opened just all at once, in an instant. You find that, for example, in Acts 16:14. Paul shares the gospel with a businesswoman, a woman named Lydia. We read, "The Lord opened her heart." We could have said her eyes, same thing. And she received Christ there and then, and she was baptized. So this isn't laying down a sort of rigid template for all subsequent eye-opening, you know, as if it's a sort of rigid two-stage process. But having these two issues separated out in this way in Mark's gospel, it helps us, doesn't it? It helps us see the importance of both of these issues, that someone needs to see both who Jesus is and why he's come. It does perhaps flag up that coming to Christ, it may be a process for some people, perhaps over some time, a process of their eyes being gradually opened spiritually. And so we need to be patient. Just the other day, someone was telling me that it took the best part of a year with them reading through the gospel accounts with a Christian friend until the penny dropped for them. Or for another guy, he said it was a year and a half of doing the same thing until the light was switched on for him. And even after someone has received Christ, there is a sense, isn't there, in which our eyes need to continue to be opened more and more to spiritual reality. That's why Paul, in Ephesians 1:18, he prays for Christians. He prays that they would have the eyes of your hearts enlightened, that you may know what is the hope to which he has called you. So you see, even as believers, we should be praying for ongoing and clearer vision of spiritual truth. But our biggest concern should be for those who are still spiritually blind. They're without God, they're without hope in the world, and we need to be praying that their eyes would be opened before it's too late. Amy Carmichael, in her dream of the blind walking towards this cliff edge and then over the cliff edge, she writes also in this piece about two other groups of people. People who could see. One group were guards, they were sentries, who were stationed at intervals along the cliff edge, and they were warning people, and they were urging people to turn back. The other group were sitting under a tree, unconcerned, their backs turned to the cliff and to what was going on, and they were making daisy chains. I found a discussion thread on some forum online about the following question. If I see a blind guy walking off a cliff and I do nothing to stop him, did I commit murder? If I see a blind guy walking off a cliff, I do nothing to stop him, did I commit murder? Some people were discussing this in this thread, and I think the conclusion was, legally, no, but morally, yes. Well, may you have the compassion of Jesus for those who are spiritually blind, as we ourselves once were.